sit down, Nurse Talus." The other girls would have laughed if they had dared, for they all had the same initial, but they correctly sensed that permission had not been granted. This was the time of hygiene lectures and of practicing blanket baths on life-size models. Mrs. McIntosh, Lady Chase, and Baby George, whose blandly impaired physique allowed him to double as a baby girl. It was the time of adapting to unthinking obedience, of learning to carry bedpans in a stack, and remembering a fundamental rule: never walk up a ward without bringing something back. Physical discomfort helped close down Bryony's mental horizons. The high starched collars rubbed her neck raw. Washing her hands a dozen times a day under stinging cold water with a block of soda brought on her first chilblains. The shoes she had to buy with her own money fiercely pinched her toes. The uniform, like all uniforms, eroded identity, and the daily attention required, ironing pleats, pinning hats, straightening seams, shoe polishing, especially the heels, began a process by which other concerns were slowly excluded. By the time the girls were ready to start their course as probationers and to work in the wards, they were never to say on, under Sister Drummond, and to submit to the daily routine from bedpan to Bovril, their previous lives were becoming indistinct. Their minds had emptied to some extent. Their defences were down, so that they were easily persuaded of the absolute authority of the ward sister. There could be no resistance as she filled their vacated minds. It was never said, but the model behind this process was military. Miss Nightingale, who was never to be referred to as Florence, had been in the Crimea long enough to see the value of discipline, strong lines of command, and well-trained troops. So when she lay in the dark, listening to Fiona begin her night-long snoring, she slept on her back, Bryony already sensed that the parallel life, which she could imagine so easily from her visits to Cambridge as a child to see Leon and Cecilia, would soon begin to diverge from her own. This was her student life now, these 4 years, this enveloping regime, and she had no will, no freedom to leave. She was abandoning herself to a life of strictures, rules, obedience, housework, and a constant fear of disapproval. She was one of a batch of probationers. There was a new intake every few months, and she had no identity beyond her badge. There were no tutorials here, no one losing sleep over the precise course of her intellectual development. She emptied and sluiced the bedpans, swept and polished floors, made cocoa and Bovril, fetched and carried, and was delivered from introspection. At some point in the future, she knew from listening to the second-year students, she would begin to take pleasure in her competence. She had had a taste of it lately, having been entrusted with taking a pulse and temperature under supervision and marking the readings on a chart. In the way of medical treatments, she had already dabbed gentian violet on ringworm, aquaflavin emulsion on a cut, and painted lead lotion on a bruise. But mostly she was a maid, a skivvy, and in her hours off, a crammer of simple facts. She was happy to have little time to think of anything else. But when she stood on her landing in her dressing gown last thing at night, and she looked across the river at the unlit city, she remembered the unease that was out there in the streets as well as in the wards, and was like the darkness itself. Nothing in her routine, not even Sister Drummond, could protect her from it. In the half hour before lights out after cocoa, the girls would be in and out of each other's rooms, sitting on their beds, writing letters home or to their sweethearts. Some still cried a little from homesickness, and there would be much comforting going on at this time with arms around shoulders and soothing words. It seemed theatrical to Bryony and ridiculous, grown young women tearful for their mothers, or, as one of the students put it through her sobs, for the smell of Daddy's pipe. Those doing the consoling seemed to be enjoying themselves rather too much. In this cloying atmosphere, Bryony sometimes wrote her own concise letters home, which conveyed little more than that she was not ill, not unhappy, not in need of her allowance, and not about to change her mind in the way that her mother had predicted. Other girls proudly wrote out their exacting routines of work and study to astound their loving parents. Bryony confided these matters only to her notebook, and even then in no great detail. She did not want her mother to know about the lowly work she did. Part of the purpose of becoming a nurse was to work for her independence. It was important to her that her parents, especially her mother, knew as little about her life as possible. Apart from a string of repeated questions which remained unanswered, Emily's letters were mostly about the evacuees. Three mothers with seven children, all from the Hackney area of London, had been billeted on the Tallis family. One of the mothers had disgraced herself in the village pub and was now banned. Another woman was a devout Catholic who walked 4 miles with her three children to the local town for Mass on Sunday. But Betty, a Catholic herself, was not sensitive to these differences. She hated all the mothers and all their children. They told her on the first morning that they did not like her food. She claimed to have seen the churchgoer spitting on the hallway floor. The oldest of the children, a 13-year-old boy who looked no bigger than 8, had got into the fountain, climbed onto the statue, and snapped off the Triton's horn and his arm right down to the elbow. Jack said that it could be fixed without too much trouble. But now the part, which had been carried into the house and left in the scullery, was missing. On information from old Hardman, Betty accused the boy of throwing it in the lake. The boy said he knew nothing. There was talk of draining the lake, but there was concern for the pair of mating swans. The mother was fierce in her son's defence, saying that it was dangerous to have a fountain when children were about, and that she was writing to the MP Sir Arthur Ridley, who was Bryony's godfather. Still, Emily thought they should consider themselves lucky to have evacuees, because at one point it had looked like the whole house was going to be requisitioned for use by the army. They settled instead on Hugh Van Vliet's place because it had a snooker table. Her other news was that her sister Hermione was still in Paris, but thinking of relocating to Nice, and the cows had been moved into 3 fields on the north side so that the park could be ploughed up for corn. 1.5 miles of iron fencing dating from the 1750s had been taken away to be melted down to make spitfires. Even the workman who removed it said it was the wrong kind of metal. A cement and brick pillbox had been built down by the river, right on the bend among the sedges, destroying the nests of the teal and the grey wagtails. Another pillbox was being built where the main road entered the village. They were storing all the fragile pieces in the cellars, including the harpsichord. Wretched Betty dropped Uncle Clem's vase carrying it down, and it shattered on the steps. She said the pieces had simply come away in her hand, but that was hardly to be believed. Danny Hardman had joined the Navy, but all the other boys in the village had gone into the East Surreys. Jack was working far too hard. He attended a special conference, and when he came back he looked tired and thin and wasn't allowed to tell her where he had been. He was furious about the vase and actually shouted at Betty, which was so unlike him. On top of it all, she had lost a ration book, and they had to do without sugar for 2 weeks. The mother, who was banned from the Red Lion, had come without her gas mask, and no replacement was to be had. The ARP warden, who was PC Vockin's brother, had been round a third time for a blackout inspection. He was turning out to be quite a little dictator. No one liked him. Reading these letters at the end of an exhausting day, Bryony felt a dreamy nostalgia, a vague yearning for a long-lost life. She could hardly feel sorry for herself. She was the one who had cut herself off from home. In the week's holiday after preliminary training, before the probationer year began, she had stayed with her uncle and aunt in Primrose Hill and had resisted her mother on the telephone. Why could Bryony not visit even for a day, when everyone would adore to see her and was desperate for her stories about her new life? And why did she write so infrequently? It was difficult to give a straight answer. For now, it was necessary to stay away. In the drawer of her bedside locker, she kept a foolscap notebook with marbled cardboard covers. Taped to the spine was a length of string, on the end of which was a pencil. It was not permitted to use pen and ink in bed. She began her journal at the end of the first day of preliminary training, and managed at least 10 minutes most nights before lights out. Her entries consisted of artistic manifestos, trivial complaints, character sketches, and simple accounts of her day, which increasingly shaded off into fantasy. She rarely read back over what she had written, but she liked to flip the filled pages. Here, behind the name badge and uniform, was her true self, secretly hoarded, quietly accumulating. She had never lost that childhood pleasure in seeing pages covered in her own handwriting. It almost didn't matter what she wrote. Since the drawer did not lock, she was careful to disguise her descriptions of Sister Drummond. She changed the names of the patients, too. And having changed the names, it became easier to transform the circumstances and invent. She liked to write out what she imagined to be their rambling thoughts. She was under no obligation to the truth. She had promised no one a chronicle. This was the only place she could be free. She built little stories, not very convincing, somewhat overwritten, around the people on the ward. For a while she thought of herself as a kind of medical Chaucer, whose wards thronged with colourful types, coves, topers, old hats, nice dears with a sinister secret to tell. In later years she regretted not being more factual, not providing herself with a store of raw material. It would have been useful to know what happened, what it looked like, who was there, what was said. At the time, the journal preserved her dignity. She might look and behave like and live the life of a trainee nurse, but she was really an important writer in disguise. And at a time when she was cut off from everything she knew, family, home, friends, writing was the thread of continuity. It was what she had always done. They were rare, the moments in the day when her mind could wander freely. Sometimes she would be sent on an errand to the dispensary and would have to wait for the pharmacist to return. Then she would drift along the corridor to a stairwell where a window gave her a view of the river. Imperceptibly, her weight would shift to her right foot as she stared across at the Houses of Parliament without seeing them, and thought not about her journal, but about the long story she had written and sent away to a magazine. During her stay in Primrose Hill, she borrowed her uncle's typewriter, took over the dining room and typed out her final draft with her forefingers. She was at it all week for more than 8 hours a day, until her back and neck ached, and ragged curls of unfurling ampersands swam across her vision. But she could hardly remember a greater pleasure than at the end, when she squared off the completed pile of pages, 103, and felt at the tips of her raw fingers the weight of her creation. All her own. No one else could have written it. Keeping a carbon copy for herself, she wrapped her story, such an inadequate word, in brown paper, took the bus to Bloomsbury, walked to the address in Lansdowne Terrace, the office of the new magazine Horizon, and delivered the package to a pleasant young woman who came to the door. What excited her about her achievement was its design, the pure geometry and the defining uncertainty which reflected, she thought, a modern sensibility. The age of clear answers was over. So was the age of characters and plots. Despite her journal sketches, she no longer really believed in characters. They were quaint devices that belonged to the 19th century. The very concept of character was founded on errors that modern psychology had exposed. Plots, too, were like rusted machinery whose wheels would no longer turn. A modern novelist could no more write characters and plots than a modern composer could a Mozart symphony. It was thought, perception, sensations that interested her. The conscious mind as a river through time, and how to represent its onward roll, as well as all the tributaries that would swell it and the obstacles that would divert it. If only she could reproduce the clear light of a summer's morning, the sensations of a child standing at a window, the curve and dip of a swallow's flight over a pool of water. The novel of the future would be unlike anything in the past. She had read Virginia Woolf's The Waves 3 times and thought that a great transformation was being worked in human nature itself, and that only fiction, a new kind of fiction, could capture the essence of the change. To enter a mind and show it at work or being worked on, and to do this within a symmetrical design, this would be an artistic triumph. So thought Nurse Tallis as she lingered near the dispensary, waiting for the pharmacist to return and gazing across the Thames, oblivious to the danger she was in of being discovered standing on one leg by Sister Drummond. 3 months had passed, and Bryony had heard nothing from Horizon. A second piece of writing also brought no response. She had gone to the administration office and asked for Cecilia's address. In early May, she had written to her sister. Now she was beginning to think that silence was Cecilia's answer.
This ends Disc 9.